Shane Carruth is living every first-time movie maker's dream. Primer, his ultra-low-budget film, won the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival, and it's earning heaps of positive reviews in major papers, including the New York Times. Esquire called it the headiest, most singular science fiction movie since Kubrick made 2001. And Carruth isn't your average filmmaker. He was a math major in college who taught himself the art of filmmaking. To borrow the critic A.O. Scott's description, Primer tells the story of two would-be inventors, Abe and Aaron. Working after hours in their suburban garage, the pair stumble onto an invention whose application is not obvious at first, but whose ethical and metaphysical implications quickly become enormous. Here's a clip.
Okay, well, I want to do what you did, okay? Exactly what you did.
Okay, the first thing I did is call in sick.
Okay, I did that.
And then I drove to the storage facility.
Okay, but I need to drop Lauren off at school first.
Okay, then meet me there. We're going to need both cars. But we need to park yours way down the road, out of sight of the facility.
Wait, why are we doing that?
Because we need to ride home.
What is that?
I know, it'll make sense.
Okay, no, I'll be patient.
When I got to the storage room, I flooded the box with argon, and then I had to tighten it up to secure the leaks.
There's leaks?
There's always leaks. At 8:30 a.m., I set the timer for 15 minutes, jumped in the car, and drove to Russell Field.
Okay, I lost it.
What?
Why the timer?
Because the moment we start those machines is the moment we'll end up getting out of them, and...
Right, got it, sorry.
I don't want to be standing around when they do.
Yep.
While I was on the road at 8:45, the machine kicked on by itself, and by 8:49, it was completely warmed up. In Russell Field, I got a hotel room and tried to isolate myself. So I got to the storage room at about 3:15 and cut off the power of the box. It cycled down to a tolerable level at about 3:19. You see, the trick is to get in after it reaches a comfortable level, but before it shuts off completely. There's a window there.
So, does it hurt?
Yeah, it does a little. It's not bad, though, if you wait for the right time. It's like a small static shock. Once you're in, you're fine, though.
What? I know you've done it, okay? And I can only assume that you don't have cancer or male impotence because of it, but I mean, what is your opinion on how safe this thing is?
Aaron, I can imagine no way in which this thing would be considered anywhere remotely close to safe. All I know is I spent 6 hours in there, and I'm still alive.
Now here's Shane Carruth describing the opening scenes for N Strange Champs.
Well, at the beginning, they're basically mimicking this device that actually exists in the real world in the Netherlands. It's basically a high-powered superconductor that, when it's cooled to near absolute zero, and it's about the size of a house, but it exhibits a quality called diamagnetism, so objects that aren't metallic or magnetic will actually levitate within the field of the superconductor. So that's what these guys are trying to do, only they're trying to, you know, make it more efficient and not have to cool it to near absolute zero. They're finding ways around that. And what happens is the device ends up being something else entirely, and they end up investigating the side effects of it, and it winds up being the thing that ends up being...
Is this kind of a typical story in science? You know, it's the unexpected side effect that turns out to blow your mind?
Well, it definitely is, at least in my reading of real-world innovation. It does seem like, I mean, with John Bearden and the transistor, you know, he was trying to come up with a more pure form of vacuum tube when, on accident, he discovers from the materials in his lab this transistor effect, and it winds up launching, you know, a several trillion-dollar industry. I think, you know, with the development of calculus and Newton, the same thing sort of was happening. He's got this incredibly powerful tool set called the calculus, except it's all based on the idea of breaking things into an infinite number of parts and then adding them up. And the concept of infinity at that time was not something that was, it wasn't concrete. It was something that was sort of a parlor trick, if anything, and he didn't like that idea. So it was kind of, it seems like there's always this moment when in innovation where you're not exactly sure what's going on, and it really is a matter of investigating the thing that is in front of you.
There was value in the thing, clearly. That they were certain of. But what is the application? In a matter of hours, they'd turned it to everything from mass transit to satellite launching, imagining devices the size of jumbo jets. Everything would be cheaper. It was practical, and they knew it. But above all that, beyond the positives, they knew that the easiest way to be exploited is to sell something they did not yet understand. So they kept quiet.
What is the machine that the guys wind up building?
It's a time reversal machine. This is a machine that, it's the arrow of time is reversed inside this machine, or it's somehow different. You turn it on at 9 a.m. and then you get in it at 3 p.m. And so 6 hours have passed. And when you get in at 3 p.m, you wait 6 hours. And when you exit, it will be 9 a.m. On the outside world.
Is this a machine that theoretically could actually work, or is this just pure imagination?
I think the prevailing theories on any kind of moving through time have to do with warp space and wormholes and stuff, and this definitely isn't that. This is setting up a separate space and using the theories that we have about time in our universe. I mean, basically, this idea that time is circular, that there is no true beginning even in our universe, that the nature of time itself springs from the Big Bang. So time is curved at the beginning, and the idea is that it's also curved at the end. So if you set up this separate universe inside our box in the film and you turn it on at 12 o'clock and then turn it off at 12:01, well, that's the beginning and end of the universe. So time curves at the beginning and end, and it folds back on itself. So you can kind of, our lead characters end up using that to their advantage by catching one of the loops backwards.
This is what's going on. There's an AN and there's a BN. Okay, let's say the AN is 12 o'clock, the BN is 12:01. All right, we start the machine with the Weeble at the AN. It travels forward normally.
You gotta write this down.
Aaron, there's nothing to write down.
Well, then I'm writing it.
Okay, fine. Look, it travels forward normally towards the BN, and when it gets there, the feed runs down parabolically until it's just stopped, but it doesn't. It curves back around towards the AN. And when it gets back to the AN, now curve that around. Okay, now the Weeble has experienced a total of 2 minutes, and again, It curves parabolically. Right. So it comes back around again, and it does this about 1,300 times. And when it finally exits on the BN, it's traveling an odd number of forward and backward trips.
Wow, this may not be your career, but you sound extremely conversant with it. Do you have a lifelong love of science and math?
I find myself reading a lot of it. I didn't study it formally. I mean, I have a degree in math, but not anything formal as far as physics. But I really do. It's very interesting to me.
Is there any particular kind of math you like best?
Yeah, there is. Nonlinear dynamics is the study of recursive equations, which I think are very interesting. I think it's a tool that's very handy in dealing with what a lot of our modern day. It's the idea of x equals or y equals x to the second, and then the equation goes on forever. And what you do is you take that answer for y and you feed it right back in for x, and you see. And you do that, 100, 1,000, an infinite number of times, and then you see what this equation does. You map it out.
So it's a circle, like your time machine.
Pretty much, yeah. And you either get some chaotic results, or you get some very interesting, almost organic looking results sometimes, which is basically where fractals come from.
Did you also like the idea of playing with ideas about time? You know, and the whole logic of, well, what would happen if you went back in time?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I knew I needed this device in the film that was going to give these guys this power. And, going through the checklist of what this thing can be, when I got to the device that affects time, it did seem like, not only does it really satisfy the risk heightening that I need, but it also, I thought it was interesting. I thought there was almost a common sense way that I would like to see a machine like this work, and how, if we've all seen Back to the Future and Bill and Ted's and all these other works of fiction, and we know about causality and paradoxes, well, let's say that our lead characters know that too. And so how would they avoid these things? So a lot of what they do when they start using the machine is very methodical, because they're worried about paradoxes and they're not very interested in trying to confront them. They just want to make cash to begin with.
That's another thing. Unlike a lot of the more kind of fictional adventure, science fiction kind of movies about time travel, this is very grounded in our world and sort of asks the question, well, if you and your best friend made a time machine, what would you do with it?
The thing I'd always seen these guys is technically they're experts, but ethically they're just kids. I mean, they've never really had to deal with any kind of moral implications of what they're doing. And it was important to me that when these ethical issues arise, that they're not expecting them, that they're not having, long, ponderous discussions about it, that they're sort of blindsided by them. And so I wanted them to be as base as I could get them. And the first thing, I think it's maybe 20 seconds of screen time between the time that they realize that they've got this ability to move through time and when they're actually trading stocks.
Yeah, always, first they look that's first they consider winning the lottery.
Right.
And is that what you'd do if you had a time machine?
Yeah, I probably would. I mean, at first, because it's just, you've got this opportunity. Let's uh, Let's store up some cash, and then let's figure out the wonders of the universe.
Mm-hmm. How did you get from math and engineering and science to film? I mean, that's a big leap that often people don't make.
Yeah. I started writing short stories in college. I think I had some kind of a weird awakening where I finally realized what a story can do, that it's more than just something to entertain you minute by minute, that there's subtext and irony and all the things that we want to get from great novels. So I became obsessed with that, and I started writing short stories. And then when I got out of school, in my spare time, I went to work on this novel that I'll never finish. But all of that got me closer and closer to screenplay format because I found that I like to write what you can observe. I'd rather not write inner monologues about what people are thinking or feeling if I can find an interesting way to show it by their actions. And so I started focusing more and more on the format, and then eventually it was a matter of time before I started to wonder if I could execute one of these things. I was seeing a lot of these great lower-budget films that have a big impact story-wise, and I just wanted to try my hand.
You know, there's a kind of traditional divide between the mathematical, logical world and the storytelling world. And we tend to think of those almost as two different sorts of brain functions. Do you? I mean, are math and storytelling more similar than maybe we'd think?
I think they are. To be honest, my opinion is I have a very hard time understanding this whole left brain, right brain thing. I really do think that it's sort of a 20th century type invention, this whole idea. The few psychology courses I've taken that talk about it, it doesn't seem to add up. I know that when I was doing upper level math and I was writing stories at the same time, it didn't feel like it was different. It always feels like it's the same thing. You're lost in a sea of large number of variables, and you've got to find a way to make them orderly and interesting. It seems like the same thing to me.
But aren't there constraints in math in that you're dealing with actual reality? There's only so far you can go, right?
But
with storytelling, there are no limits. You can make up anything you want.
Well, I guess maybe that's the thing, is I do see the limits on storytelling, because I do think you can't do anything you want. You can, because I think people get bored. You've got to ground it in some kind of realism. So the equation you're trying to solve when you're telling a story is, okay, you've got to be interesting, but at the same time, and you've got to have, you know, your subtext, and you've got to map your story onto that. But at the same time, you've also got to tell it in a way that people are going to believe it, that you're not just, I don't know, telling them some kind of dream that you had. I mean, I lose interest when I start hearing about people's dream when I know they're not mapped onto something underneath.
So it's still like constructing a gigantic puzzle or something where the pieces all have to fit into place?
I do think, I know that probably turns off a lot of people, but I do think that's probably the way it is, at least for me.
Do you want to make any more films about math and science?
I have four story ideas that I'm incredibly passionate about, and three of them have something to do with science.
Your film and a bunch of others that we've seen recently, Proof and Pi and books too, have started to make science seem really edgy and fun and exciting. Is that part of what you're trying to do with this film?
No, only because I see science as edgy and exciting, so I'm not trying to make it that way. I don't know. This is the type of movie that I would want to see. You know, as I finished the script and I was trying to figure out how to execute this thing, I happened to see All the President's Men, and I was really inspired by it because it was roughly, you know, the same structure that I was trying to do, this investigative procedural by two guys that are basically, you know, figuring out little pieces of information that add up to something bigger. And in All the President's Men, there's a great deal of journalistic lingo that, you know, your average audience is not going to pick up on exactly what they're saying, but they're going to get the gist of it. That's the story about journalism that I want to see. I don't want to see it dumbed down where we're talking about, you know, editors yelling across desks and your stereotypical reporters and stuff. I want to see what it looks like in the real world. And so this is just my attempt at seeing what garage-level innovation probably looks like.
Shane Carruth wrote, directed, and starred in the movie Primer. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him.